Blog Talk Radio.
Since Plato first penned his foundational works, many a tale teller has spun a fantastic yarn of long ago times and set it in ancient Atlantis. One of the most recent was a television series that explored the lost continent through the lens of Greek mythology. Epic heroes like Jason and Hercules, along with historical figures like Pythagoras, adventure in a land not unlike mythic Minoan Crete, and revisit the classical legends. Though unseen, Poseidon is an all-powerful and forever present. Alas, the series was not renewed for a third season, which is unfortunate, as it was leading to the voyage of the Argo. But the two-season adventure is now immortalized on Blu-ray, DVD, and streaming. I will share my impressions of the first show with you, called The Earth Book. In modern times, Jason seeks to solve the mystery of his father's long-ago disappearance at sea. His mini-sub is engulfed by a bright light, and he awakens in Atlantis. Culture shock causes him to become a fugitive. He unwittingly finds shelter with Pythagoras and his roommate Hercules. He knows of them, but neither is quite what he expected. His father's necklace, the horns of a bull, leads him to the oracle, who provides him with vague answers, which, nonetheless, provide him with valuable information. The three companions then live out the Theseus legend, slay the Minotaur, and lift the curse that plagued Atlantis. They are honored by the royal family and hailed as heroes. And were that it remains so, but they went on to have many amazing adventures, which I will cover in future segments of Legends of Hercules. And now, without further ado, I bring you Spaced Out with Bob Vossler.
Hello,
greetings,
everyone.
Bob.
How you doing, Hercules?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Bob?
I am doing fantastic, and I'm enjoying this topic among all the topics that we do, but we are entering the Twilight Zone tonight, and with my good friend Gary Clay, and we're going to have a blast because that is quite a classic series and an interesting saga of revivals as well. So we're going to have fun.
I'm looking forward to it. I'll be here if you need me.
All righty. Well, Cher, thank you for being part of tonight's show, and I know that you are definitely a Twilight Zone fan. You have previously administered, monitored a Facebook page devoted to Twilight Zone, and did an excellent job with that. But I know you're a big fan, and maybe we could start off with. Well, and I know you, of course, through our Star Trek Association, and we just enjoyed Philly Fan Expo last weekend, and I know that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was.
It was tiring, but we, you know, it was that kind of, it was the kind of fun that you didn't mind getting exhausted for. I mean, we just, you know, it was so big, and but it was great to see all those fans come out, and everybody was so friendly there. I had many a conversation with total strangers.
Yeah, it's been a while, you know, since we've gotten to a convention. And this is the first one for me in, like, almost 3 years. So, you know, it was pretty good getting out with the fans, looking at the costumes, looking at the uniforms, and just chatting with people. So it was pretty cool.
Yeah, and while I had hit some local smaller comic book collectible shows, I had not gotten near anything this mega before until before the pandemic. So it was really nice, and it was good to catch up with all of you folks over there. But let's talk some Twilight Zone, a show that of course, Rod Serling was certainly ahead of his time, much like Gene Roddenberry. And I looked up and saw that he had written more than 80 episodes of the 150 plus of the original series. And I knew he did a lot. He was the driving force behind it. But he also had some wonderful other writers as well. Earl Hamner, more familiar to fans from the Waltons, but Earl Hamner wrote some of the many interesting episodes as well, many of which were had sort of a country flavor to them. I saw one this week on Sci-Fi Channel called The Fear. Do you remember that one where the brother sister were in by their pool, and this was a very successful like Hollywood family, and the father was probably a real, you know, he had an important job, and it looked like the mom was probably an actress or something, and they were in the midst of telling the kids that they were going to have a divorce because they, even though they had this seemingly wonderful family, they were just not happy, and the two dived into the pool.
Okay,
and
that was the Bewitching pool. The Bewitching
yeah.
pool.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe I got the title wrong.
I messed up myself. 156 episodes. You can't remember them all. That's definitely
no,
for sure.
No, and most of them were very good. And what struck me on that episode, and I had forgotten it because that was one I hadn't seen in a while, was that for whatever reason, the young girl in the show, I believe her voice was dubbed over by the very famous voice actress who recently died and who I can't think of her name at the moment, but she only recently died within the last year and was like the voice of Natasha, you know, from the Bullwinkle and Rocky and did so many. And what makes me really feel bad and makes me feel old is I interviewed this woman years ago, and her name is going to come up, you know, I'll probably.
Fournay? Is her name Fournay?
Yes, I think June Fournette. Thank you.
You're welcome.
yes, because that would have been bothering me. She was such a sweet woman when I saw her at a convention and got to interview her. Ironically, I think I interviewed her for the original Spaced Out, which was a video show back in the 80s. But I don't remember. Do you know anything about that episode or why that happened? I would imagine probably the actress that they chose didn't have a good voice, but I don't. It seemed weird to me.
Yeah, everybody says that the voice doesn't match what went previously on the episode. I'm not exactly sure why they dubbed that voice, but they probably obviously thought it sounded a lot better than the girls did.
Yeah. I was just curious because I had forgotten that it certainly didn't mar the episode, and it was a good episode, and it definitely, like all Twilight Zone episodes, made you think. And in the Twilight Zone had, while this one didn't have any real name actors in it, so many other episodes did bring us like young actors that would become big stars. Burt Reynolds, Robert Redford, Roddy McDowall, Charles Bronson, and of course our lovely Susan Oliver, who was in the same episode as Roddy McDowall.
Don't forget Bill Mumy.
Oh, yeah.
Bill Mumy?
Yes. We'll get to him because I found out some interesting things about him when I did a little research, more than I realized. Lloyd Bachner, of course, from the famous To Serve Man with Richard Kiel being the alien. And of course, there were stars who did multiple parts, you know, multiple roles. Burgess Meredith, I think, did at least four, maybe more.
Right.
Jack Coleman definitely did four or five. And William Shatner did at least two. Leonard Nimoy did one. George Takei did one. And he was in the episode that was actually banned for a while in the syndication package. It gave us a glimpse. But do you recall the first Twilight Zone episode that you saw?
Well, the one I remember the most would be Eye of the Beholder.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, her name was Janet Tyler, and she went into the hospital because she was ugly. Now, anyone who has to have 11 surgeries because they think they're ugly, oh, that's a little bit too much, okay?
Yeah.
She was really wanted to get to where everyone else was. Maxine Stewart was the voice underneath all those, that gauze wrap around her head. It wasn't Donna Douglas. It was Maxine Stewart. And it was a shocker. It really was. I wasn't expecting the ending at all. on that reveal, that's the one I remember the best.
Yeah, that was one of those great, you know, which is what Twilight Zone's trademark, being the twist ending. And that certainly fit that mark. And it had the wonderful Richard Long in it from, you know, Big Valley and Nanny and the Professor. He was one of the, you know, model guys. Yeah, and Donna Douglas. I forgot that her voice wasn't, you know, was also dubbed out in favor of a different voice. But this is years before, you know, before her time on Beverly Hillbillies.
Well, actually, what happened was she learned Maxine Stewart's voice so well, okay, from Maxine taping, you know, the dialogue, mm-hmm. that they actually let Donna say one line in that whole episode because she could mimic Maxine so well.
Oh, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about the series that made you such a fan?
Twist endings. Like Time Enough at Last. Oh, mm-hmm. my God. that was a really big one for me.
And tell some of our listeners who may not remember that one from the title what that one was all about. Because I don't always the titles myself, but I know I've seen every episode, you know, multiple times, but I don't always catch all the.
Right. That's no problem. Guy named Henry Bemis. Bookworm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh,
and
course.
His wife never let him read, which is a shame. Mm. So he kind of like snuck down to the vault during lunch all the time, mm-hmm. and he would read. And
yeah.
I thought there was some foreshadowing done in this episode, believe it or not. If you watch it really closely, okay, when his wife is ripping pages out of the book and he drops to his knees and he's, like, collecting the pages, his glasses slip off onto the floor. Okay, and at the end of the episode, Burgess Meredith, Henry Bemis, bends down and his glasses fall off his face. So I thought that was a cute little thing. I don't know how many people caught that. Okay. But that was a nice little touch that they had in there. So if you watch it real careful, you can see it.
Yeah. I know they periodically have marathons on either Sci-Fi Channel or some other channels. And the last time I didn't catch that episode, but I got to watch that over again because these are shows that you could definitely watch over and just like Star Trek over and over and over again and still appreciate and still find some new, you know, something new in them, a nuance that you overlooked or forgot. And just Burgess Meredith is just such an incredible talent. I mean, in every episode he was in, like as Bemis, he was this innocent guy. You felt bad for him. He had this shrew of a wife. He had, you know, he wasn't really happy. All he wanted was a little peace and a diversion by reading books. And then he was denied that at the very end. And you know, and to hear him say, you're like, this isn't fair. This isn't fair. And it wasn't. You felt so bad for him, you know. Like, you felt more bad for him than the fact that the entire planet was, you know, decimated. But in other episodes, and I don't know the title, but the episode, and I can relate to this being in journalism, the episode about the newspaper where he's basically the devil, and he makes this with, you know, that was a great episode. And you see, you know, like, and he looks different. He doesn't, he's not this innocent little guy. He's a devil. You're rooting for the other people here, but he's like such a great, you know, such a great villain. And every episode he was in, he just brought something new to the table.
In the Obsolete Man, he was fabulous in that episode. I really liked him, the way he played. And he was also, he was a librarian, believe it or not. So that kind of ties in with Time Enough at Last. And he was considered obsolete because he was a librarian. And, you know, they read books. So there you are. So that kind of connected to, you know, the Time Enough at Last episode.
And wasn't his nemesis Fritz Weaver in that episode? That the actor Fritz Weaver, or am I mixing up my episodes? Who was his enemy? Who is the one who said he was obsolete? And
I'm looking at something
another
else, but yeah,
another, you know. They had just so many wonderful actors in this. Even ones that didn't go on to become famous, where, you know, they left you with something. One of my favorites among the many was one with William Wyndham, our favorite Commodore from the Doomsday machine, and was the soldier who, you know, when they're all trying to climb out of this pit. You know, the ballerina, the clown, and he was the soldier. And,
five characters, yes.
Yeah,
that was a good one.
And then he finally is able to climb out, and he falls, and it's basically, you know, a child picks it up, and it's G.I. Joe, you know. Another one of those great twist endings. And I think one of the ones that I also loved, especially when it airs around holiday time, is Art Carney, you know, playing
Night
this,
of the Meek,
Night of the Meek, and which again has a Star Trek connection because, of course, you know, our favorite actor from you know, who's Red Jack, you know, who owns the department store. And ends up having a drink with the cop at the end of the show. But Art Carney just completely shined in that episode. And years later, he would go on to play Santa Claus in a holiday special. I believe it also featured Jacqueline Smith. I could be wrong on this, but in that. And I think it was also good for it to be in – I think that's one of the few episodes that was also Kinescope. It wasn't really filmed, but it just, you know, it, and Kinescope doesn't always look well, at least that's my opinion. But I think for that episode, it worked so well because it made it look more shabby. It made it look more, and that's what they were going for. And, it was just a wonderful episode, and his lines, you know, were perfect. And it really brought home the whole theme. What did you think of Rod Serling being the host of the show? Because that almost didn't happen. But Clost made, you know, was certainly one thing. And I think you can't picture Twilight Zone, at least the original, without him or with anybody else. And
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, they had a few other people like Desi Arnaz. They considered to be, you know, one of the moderators for the Twilight Zone.
Yeah,
and
until earlier this year, or when it might have been posted on that page, I had never over these many years had heard that. And at first I read it and I was like, no, that can't possibly be true.
It is.
But yeah.
I posted it, so I know.
Yeah, it was like, you know, like I thought, like, is Cher pulling our leg here? You know, like, but no. When I read the whole thing and it's like, oh my God.
Well, and Orson Welles was almost tapped to do it too, but then Rod Serling said he'll do it. He just said the heck with it. It was cheaper for him to do it than to hire somebody else to do it. But he was very nervous. Every time he went in front of the camera, he was like very rattled, shaking and stuff. You wouldn't know it to look at him, but he was. And they had these little tricks that they did to him to, you know, get him to kind of relax, you know, trying to get him to mellow out.
Well, I think Orson Welles was just too expensive. But Orson Welles, I could almost picture it. It would have been much different. But I'm glad that Rod was there. And even, I think I did sense a little nervousness on him, but I think that actually helped the show because I think it made it a little bit more edgy that he was, you know, kind of mysterious. And years later, when I met his daughter, who had written her book, this only goes back maybe within the last 10 years or so, and she came to one of our Starfleet functions that was hosted, ironically, by the USS Serling, based in Binghamton, New York, which has a connection to Rod. And she came there, and she was a guest at that regional conference of Starfleet Region 7, and she was just a wonderful speaker, and she had mentioned that her father was a much different man than the host of either the Twilight Zone or Night Gallery, and that she showed some a video or taken from old 8mm films where they were he was playing with her in the pool and laughing, and it's something you didn't normally see in footage of Rod Serling from his interviews. He was very serious and obviously hosting, but it was really, it was interesting to see another side of him, But we're certainly glad that he was the host, and there's just no replacing him, as we saw in later versions, later adaptations of the Twilight Zone. And the 1983 version of Twilight Zone, and they didn't even try, which was probably a good thing. But one thing about the Twilight Zone is that it had subcategories, really, of the show. And that's something I was going to ask you about because, I was going to ask you what your favorite episode is. But really, that's a hard question because there are more thought-provoking stories, like episodes that had a moral to them and made you think, and then there were the more horror-oriented ones, and then there were also the comical episodes, like Buster Keaton and his time travel episode, and so many more humorous episodes that was helped to balance out the show, I think. So did you have any particular favorite from those three categories?
Well, I really liked an episode called The Invaders with Agnes Moorehead.
Mm.
Now they say that she didn't speak a word in that whole episode, but she said the words "ah" and she said the word "oh." Now, I don't know about you, but those are words, okay?
Yeah.
So, yeah. But they said she did carry the whole episode by herself with these little finger puppets that they used. Mm.
You know what?
It took two fingers to do the arms, and it took two fingers to do the legs. That's how they were worked, those little puppet things. Uh-huh. I like them.
Huh. You know, and we'll go back to your other answers, but I'm glad you brought up that episode because that one is what made me mention the fear and mess up the title because I saw the fear earlier this week, and the fear was sort of a similar type episode, but not quite as dynamic as that one. That was the one where, and I can't think of the actor's name, but he was on Next Gen, and he was in a bunch of other things, and he also recently passed away. He played a sheriff, and he goes to visit this woman who has apparently is afraid of strange sounds around the house, and goes and finds this huge giant step, footprint in and then his car is moved and then during the day, later that morning, they find this giant one-eyed alien, which turns out to be, a balloon when he goes and, instead of tries to make peace with an alien, he goes and does what most people would do. Or at least at that time, he goes and shoots it, and then the wind blows them around because the air is coming out of this balloon. And then he finds tiny little aliens in the flying saucer. So it was almost the reverse, whereas we came, to the planet of the giants in the prior episode, and then the tiny aliens came to us in this episode. But it was played out differently. So,
yeah, but those aliens lived.
Right. Yeah, they got
in the invaders.
Live.
Those aliens didn't really live. Okay.
Right. And which was funny was because the flying saucer, which is clearly there in the they're looking into the their windows and everything else. You see what the flying saucer looks like, and when the flying saucer blasts off, it looks nothing like that. It's like clearly footage from Forbidden Planet or some other 1950s sci-fi thing, because Rod Serling did that all the time. He was able to use footage from other things to save money, so but nobody cared because the point was clear. They blasted off, but
Well, the biggest thing was they let Rod Serling and his production people go through all of the spaceship and everything, and they said take what you want. And Rod Serling was like, "Yo, that's great." So a lot of the things that you see in these episodes are from Forbidden Planet. So I mean, Robbie the robot, and you've got the spaceship, and you've got the lights in the background, those Pac-Man lights, they call them, those white lights.
Yeah. And we, all those sound effects too, we tend to forget about the sound effects, but you know, we definitely heard some Star Trek sound effects in the Twilight Zone. We definitely heard some other familiar, just because they would have been used before. And and were used even afterwards. So, what would you say was your favorite horror, more horror themed episode?
Well, I don't know if you consider it horror, but The Masks. Okay,
yeah.
I thought that was really, really well done and excellent acting, and it was just a great episode. And that was where it was Mardi Gras. This old guy was dying. And he invites his heirs to his house, and they have to wear masks until 12 o'clock midnight. And when they take the masks off, of course, they're disfigured. They were made to look like the masks, that they wore. And that was scary.
Yeah. And it was such a wonderful episode because really – you couldn't really come away liking these people. They were really just awful people, and you knew that whatever happened, they were going to deserve whatever they had, because the girl was just narcissistic and was only thinking of herself. That the son was, you know, had his issues of hurting animals and also kind of, you know, narcissistic in his own way and just a bully. The father was kind of greedy and, even when he said he was affable, I'm an affable man. I would describe myself as an affable man, but he was creepy. And of course the daughter, you know, who was the wife, you know, she was awful too. So, you know, at the end, when you see them now, they're deformed. I mean, you can't feel too bad, and you kind of feel like the old man got his, you know, he did exactly the right thing. They might have all the money, but now they can't go out in public.
Actually, they can if you think about it, because the granddaughter, Paula,
mm-hmm.
She wasn't really disfigured that much. She could wear glasses and go out. Most of them could wear glasses and go out, I think. I don't think that would be a problem.
Yeah, they certainly didn't look as good as they did before.
Glad that happened to them, but then you feel sorry for them in a way. So I think it's a double-edged sword there. You know, they got what they deserved.
I guess I did feel a little bad for them. And I was thinking that's an episode that is so timeless. Like, that could have been done just as easily in the 2002 version of Twilight Zone, or the 1980s version, or even the more recent version, because it's really, like, most of those episodes are almost timeless.
Right, and someone on the Facebook group asked, well, why couldn't they get surgery? And, you know, if you think about it, he got these masks specifically made for these people, okay, by, I think maybe it was a voodoo priest or priestess down there mm-hmm. in New Orleans, and I don't think that surgery would have helped those people.
Because it was
magic. It was voodoo. Okay. And, you know, you can't change that kind of thing. At least I think you can't.
Yeah. Well, you bring up a good point, which may have been yet another subcategory I didn't think of, which was that the Twilight Zone also did have an element of the supernatural to it. And someone we didn't mention who made multiple appearances in The Twilight Zone was Anne Francis. And one of her appearances was, a Jezebel episode, written, I believe, by Earl Hammond, which was a great episode and had James Best, who's best known as the sheriff of the Dukes of Hazzard, but was in so many things. And was a singer and, you know, was like more leading man material when he was so young. And, they were vying over him. And definitely, you know, that had witchcraft and the spell. And, she turned into a mountain lion or I believe. And then in the other episode, which I don't know if you'd say that was really supernatural, but the fact that mannequins came to life once a month and would spend time out in the real world, I thought that was a great episode with her.
That was a good episode. I liked it. I liked other ones better than, Midnight Sun was a good one. The Shelter was absolutely a good one. And The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, everyone loves that one.
Yeah. And that even got its sequel later on. They updated that in the 2000 version as they did with a number of the others, but we can get into that later. But the original with Claude Akins, and I don't know the name of the chubby actor there, but he excelled in roles like that, where he was kind of either the buffoon or the guy that was always nervous or the guy that would always end up doing the wrong thing. But that is such a relatable episode, especially in the world that we're in now, I think. But of the comical episodes, some of the ones with Carol Burnett and, the ones that were played a little less seriously, like our original.
The one with Beavis? The one where he had an angel and, they were supposed to change his life and everything. And it was kind of like tied with the Carol Burnett one, mm-hmm. Both of those tied together.
Yeah. I loved, there was just so many. One that wasn't maybe comical, but was a little less, was very touching, was the one with the old man who was actually an alien, and he could even transform into an alien. And that was another example of one of those times where they used a costume from a previous sci-fi movie, because when he came out from the bushes in the original, he was this alien, and the kids just thought he dressed up. But he had this great love for this little girl who was who had problems walking, and had Mrs. I can't think of the actress's name, but from Beverly Hillbillies, the woman who was the banker, who was raising the little girl, and they end up he's wanted by his race because he's the king, but he doesn't want to be king, but ends
right.
up leaving and leaves with her. And I thought that was a really touching episode. And not really, it had its funny moments, but it really wasn't played for comedy. But
and everybody on the Facebook page goes crazy every time I post something, is It's a Good Life with Bill Mooney.
Oh, that
everyone loves that. It's just such a popular episode.
Yes, that was a classic, just like Shatner's Plane Ride.
Nightmare at 20,000 feet, yeah.
And Mooney did such a wonderful job. I mean, here he is, this because even before this episode, well, we see him, I'm not sure if it was before, I think it was before that episode, because he looked
it
younger.
Was.
When
yeah.
he was in the telephone episode where his grandma, and that was another Kinescope episode where he almost, dies. But here he is, you're actually scared of this little kid, even whatever time I watch it, it's like, you can understand everybody being afraid they're going to get sent off into the cornfield.
I feel really bad for the delivery guy. You remember the delivery guy?
Yeah.
Tell Anthony that I really like him, and I got those peaches or something or whatever for him, and the mother says, oh, I'll make sure he likes you. I'll make sure I tell him. Everybody was afraid of him.
That had
I would have clocked him.
I know.
I definitely would have clocked him.
the grandma is like, and she's a little out of it, but you could tell she's like, isn't anybody going to dry, And it's ironic because in the sequel, which was in the one of several from the UPN version, which I was surprised. I thought this lasted more than one season, but it only lasted from September 18th, 2002 to May 21st, 2003. But they did 43 episodes. But the 43 episodes were, they had done 2 half-hour stories per show, which I think worked for that. And we can get into the amount of time, you know, that the Twilight Zone has experimented with. But in the sequel, Billy Mumy and his real-life daughter, who plays his daughter, and you could tell because, boy, do they look, you know, the same, Cloris Leachman is practically taking on the role of the grandmother because she's actually, you know, she's done with this after all these years. She wants to see Anthony, you know, she wants to see him gone, and even conspires with her granddaughter when she finds out that the granddaughter is now manifesting powers. And, but she ends up, you know, vanishing as well, along with all these other innocent people. And that was interesting because they end up going back and bringing, they don't bring everybody back, but they go back to the rest of the world. And
she said, I brought everyone back. So, I mean, I don't know if she meant everybody from the cornfield, because she was more powerful than Anthony. And I think Anthony started being afraid of her because he didn't realize, because she didn't manifest for a while. Okay.
That's right.
And it took her a little bit to manifest.
Well, in the introduction of the original show, didn't they say something, and I'd have to rewatch this one too, but didn't they say that really the world was still there, but this pocket of that farm was isolated unto itself? Like, it wasn't like the rest of the world was really gone. It's just that they were kind of either within their own world or a barrier or something that they couldn't get in. And so maybe what happened in the sequel was that she wished the barrier gone, because all of a sudden they see that an airplane and they see, you know, the rest of the world. And it almost seemed like Anthony was a little scared of, like, you know, because he's never lived in the real world. So I don't know what it would have happened next, but I thought that was one of those episodes that was good to have a sequel to, or another look at, like the monsters on Maple Street. There were some the ones and you and I have had this conversation about, I would love, even though they did do a sequel to it or a remake to it in the Twilight Zone movie with John Lithgow, I would love to have seen William Shatner, even now as 90 years old, or I'd love to see him, for some reason, get on a plane and encounter one of those, the original-looking gremlins on the wing, and see what happens next.
I'm sure he got a lot of comments when he flew, okay?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure everybody looked at him when he was sitting there in a plane, you know?
Yeah,
because you got to admit, that's a very popular episode, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's classic.
I like the John Lithgow version because the gremlin looks more like a gremlin would, okay, instead of a stuffed teddy bear.
Right. It was a scary face, but was more more in line to what a creature would be flying around like that. I did think that was an interesting design, even though I still have a 12-inch version or maybe larger than that of the original sitting up in my attic. I have a fondness for that, but I agree with you. The other one looked more like what a mythical gremlin would have looked like. And John Lithgow did a great job in the Twilight Zone movie with that. The storm and everything else, you just felt for the guy. But there's something about William Shatner's thing that I was always hoping that they could have brought him back and say, yeah, I'm on my way to visit my grandkid, or at this point, great-grandkid, and I've never been on a plane since. I've never wanted to go on a plane, and of course, this won't happen, and of course it does. Or you think he's imagining it happening, you know, and that becomes the story, because you think, you know, is he imagining it, or is it real? You know, is he seeing this creature all over again? So they did do another version of that, or at least they called it the same thing in the more recent Twilight Zone, which we could get into because it is getting later. So we have to touch on Jordan Peele's two seasons of the Twilight Zone. What did you think of that being the most recent version?
Actually, what I did was I got a subscription to Paramount Plus just to see that series. And I'll tell you what, I wish I could take my money back. I really do.
Yeah.
It was horrible. Oh, my God, it was so horrible.
I totally agree with you. I was so, so disappointed in that show. And even when they had the second season, I was thinking, oh, it's got to improve. Got to improve. Maybe they'll fix it. Maybe they'll. And I think, you know, my own feeling is that I think, one, the show was too long. I think it lost its twist ending punch. I think it was way too long. I think they kind of, now Twilight Zone, much like Star Trek, is known for its episodes that make you think and brings a, you know, a moral into it and social relevance and all of that. But I think that, and maybe this is because they only could produce so many episodes per season on a streaming service, but I just thought that it was very forced. I thought it was, they were really trying to hit every social issue that was currently in the news. And I'm not necessarily saying that's bad, but I just think it just came off a little too forced, and maybe because the episodes were too long, just seemed, you know, like it just lacked the punch of it. That's how I felt, but it was definitely disappointing. What do you think was it? Why did you think it failed?
Well, number one, I didn't like Jordan as the moderator. I just thought that was a little bit over the top. Just the episodes were so boring. I would slap my forehead after watching one of the episodes, and I would ask myself, what did I just watch? And I did watch them all. Okay, I did watch them all because I thought it would get better. You know, it's like you start watching a movie, and it's really not that good. But you're hoping if you stick with it, it'll get better. This didn't get better.
No. It actually went reverse. I thought the second season was actually ended up worse than the first. And one in particular, and I don't know the name, you know, I certainly don't remember the title of those. But I can so relate to what you're saying that it was boring. It was one where one guy is traveling to be with, I don't know, a girlfriend or something. All I remember is he's on a train. He finally gets there, and it's all a trap. The woman actually calls the police, and he's trapped, and you know, or he gets arrested. And I'm not even sure what was happening, but you almost, now there's twist endings that you don't see coming. Then there's also twist endings that you see a mile away, and you know this guy's an idiot, and he's gonna, you know, this is gonna turn against him. Like, you're almost like, dude, come on, you know, like you're walking into a mess here, you know, and you can't feel for the guy because they're just so dumb. And I don't know if you remember that one at all, but that was the second one of the last of the second season.
You know, honestly, I don't remember that whole series at all, to tell you the truth. It was so bad. I think I try. It's like kind of like a Star Trek movie. If one of them is bad, you just don't you know, you don't remember it that well as you know, as some of the ones that you do like. You know, like I liked Wrath of Khan. I will always remember that one. But, you know, all the other ones are just they're good, but they're not as good as that one. And I don't remember that series, to tell you the truth. It was that bad.
If you have to forget something, that is probably, you know, that's good brain matter to discharge memories from on that, because that just was not memorable. I remember what I believe was the first episode or maybe the second episode, which had that nightmare on, you know, at the 1,000 feet, because it had, I think, basically the same title. But I was waiting for the creature, and there was no creature. But you did see at the very end of the episode, they threw one of the dolls onto the beach because the plane crashed. And that was another example of, like, well, why didn't they just end it with the plane going down? Instead, it comes back, and it survives. They survive, and he's on the beach. And then they're all upset with this guy who's the guy from Parks and Rec, who ended up with, what's her name, the blonde, who's on Parks and Rec. But anyway, so at least I recognized him. But then on the beach, they had the little creature, the original gremlin from Shatner's gremlin. And I thought, well, that's cute, but that still doesn't make the episode good. The other one was that I actually do remember was the last episode of the first season. And the reason I remember it is that they CGI'd in Rod Serling. And I guess they did a good version of his voice because it certainly sounded like him. Do you remember that? Because even that one wasn't so good. Because they broke the fourth wall. Jordan Peele is actually talking. They're talking to this woman about they're producing Twilight Zone, and I don't always like it when they break the fourth wall. Rod Serling did it himself once, but it was a cute way, when that episode where the writer is creating characters, and in the end he snips Rod Serling out of it. Remember that episode?
Yeah,
from the original?
Yeah, he throws him into the fire. Yeah, the tape of him, he throws him into the fire. That was a good one.
But that was a cute thing, and that was also part, you know, was kind of, you know, part of the story. This one was way out there, and somehow at the very end, Rod Serling was in black and white, and it was CGI, and I was like, that's kind of interesting. Am I supposed to like this? Is it a nice homage? Or this didn't help make the show, that particular episode, any more interesting. Or they should have done it earlier.
I think it was to honor him, I guess, because I can't see any other reason why they would do that. And, you know, actually, the CG was really well done, actually. I think, anyway.
I had to look twice to see if that was did they somehow take footage from an earlier episode? What did they intersplice it, or was the CGI? Or, you know, but Jordan Peele's, even though his was two seasons, the one season of the UPN version, which was hosted by Forrest Whitaker, Forrest Whitaker's version had 43 episodes. And what I found out interesting about Billy Mumy was that after his sequel episode, Billy Mumy had written, or at least contributed, he was a script writer for several other episodes of that version of The Twilight Zone. But I think that version and also the 1983 version had it right in that they provided two episodes in an hour format, you know, half hour each. 1983, I think sometimes they went a little over a half hour, but then the other episode was shorter and stuff like that. But 1983's version, I liked. And I think, you know, next to the original, I think the 83 version is most loved by most, you know, fans. And it's actually out there in syndication. I don't know about I don't know about the Forrest Whitaker version. I have not seen that syndicated in quite a while. And I don't think Jordan Peele's version is I don't even think it's on Paramount Plus anymore. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it is. But very disappointing.
Well, I think if you try to improve on perfection, which maybe not a lot of the episodes in the original Twilight Zone was perfection, but it came damn close. And if you try to improve on something like that, I think that, you know, you're going to fall short in a lot of places. You know, everybody, it's 156 episodes. What's not to love? You know, I mean, each has their own little flavor.
On that note, we only have a few minutes left. We have enough time for everybody to share their contact information and a last thought.
Yes, Jared, I don't know if you want to share either. I'm not even sure which chapter you're on these days. I think you're still with Sovereign, right? Or you, wherever you are.
USS Sovereign.
You'll always be a Sovereign girl to us, so. Yeah. So that's the Starfleet chapter, and based in Philly. And Cher was a big part, you know, they were part of the team there at the Philly Fan Expo. I, of course, am with the USS Challenger, and we were glad to be there, too, in a small part, and had a blast. And we can be reached at usschallenger.org and on our Facebook page, which is USS Challenger. And, of course, there's region7.com. You could find out, you know, your more local chapter that way if you're a Star Trek fan. But even if you're not a big Star Trek fan, we're into everything. Definitely reach out and see if you want to hook up with us and have some weird and interesting times.
I like that.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Cher. Thank you for joining me and being on the show.
Thank you for having me on.
And you guys are very deeply into fandom. And that's an experience that either you're in it or you're not in it, but some people who are not in it want to find out more. So what would you recommend they do if they wanted to get involved in fandom?
That's a very good question, Hercules. I think reach out to a fellow fan or, you know, to a particular fan club, and that whoever they contact will be able to probably connect them to other particular fandoms, or just other people that are into so much. Or another point of advice is to go to one of these conventions, whether it be a small show or a huge one, like the one Cher and I just went to in Philadelphia, where you just naturally connect with people. I can't tell you how many people just came up to me, total stranger, and we had these conversations. And I even had a person that responded to me, wanted to continue the conversation on the food line. And then we had to go our separate ways. And I just said, beam aboard at AOL.com. You know, reach out to me any good. And, you know, a total strangers, they were so friendly. And we shared even the brief time that we were on the line. We shared, like, different guests that we saw, like Shatner and things, and other experiences, other cons, other fandom, other stuff, and it just brings it all together. So I would say go to one of these shows. You are absolutely bound to bump into somebody, comment on their costume, or you know, it's a friendly atmosphere. People are you're not a nerd there, because we're all nerds. We're all, you know, we're all a little weird, and that's where, you know, birds of a feather flock together, and that's the perfect place to go, I would say. You know, you're bound
Thank
to
you.
Come away with friends. So.
Thank you so much, Bob. Thank you, Cher. Have an awesome evening and rest of your week. Thanks to everybody who tuned in as well. Whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, called on a number and patiently are waiting in for you, whether you're going to check us out later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Thanks again, Bob and Cher.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.